Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Heretics Hour on this very stormy Monday, May 12th. I am Carolyn Yeager, your host, and I have some important things to say tonight, although it's a little bit distracting with this big storm going on. I'm not sure I'm even going to be able to get through this whole show, and I'm sure that you hear it. I know you can hear it because it's very loud inside. There's a lot of loud thunder right above my head here, I guess. And there's been lightning, and I lost my internet connection about 15 minutes before showtime, and I had to start it up again. And that could happen anytime. It seems like it's just a little bit quieter right now, but I have a feeling this is an all-night affair. So we'll just see. And I've got my my mailbox open. And for my loyal listeners, if you would let me know how things are sounding, if how distracting the storm is, I have got an aluminum or metal type awning outside. I'm right at a window, situated right by a window, and there's this awning out there. And there was hail coming down, so it was making a racket. You know, right where I am here, and but it's just generally very noisy out there. So we'll see if it settles down just to a dull roar, or if it, you know, gets worked up again. And at any time, I could lose my internet connection. And I was thinking that if I lose it again, I might just reschedule this show for another day, like tomorrow or something. There's some light, more lightning now, and do it then, because it's hard for me to really concentrate with all this distraction going on. So we'll just see how it goes. I'll keep going along here. I just wanted to warn you what might take place. Let's see. There was something else that I just thought of, but now I already forgot it. So this is... Okay, I wanted to tell you that I solved my sound problems. Now I've got this storm problem, but I was having sound problems, and on Thursday, doing the Hitler Table Talk show, there was a lot of rumbly sound, which really disturbed me, and I didn't know what it was, but I did find out that night and the next day. I worked on all this, and so I've discovered what that rumbly sound was, and that's I've taken care of that and made the necessary changes, and I've discovered what the knocking sound is that I was hearing then also, and when the rumbling sound wasn't getting most of my attention, and I that's actually coming from inside my computer, because the new I'm using my old microphone right now, because I switched to it thinking that this new Blue Yeti of mine, which I dearly like, and I'm determined to learn how to have to use it without it causing, you know, figure out how to deal with it, because it's so sensitive. It picks up everything, and it was picking up the sounds inside my computer, and my computer is is this newer computer I have now. It's a flat, rectangular affair, not a tower, and it sits on top of the desk, which is, well, that's where I have it, and it makes noise. It's not that I've gotten used to it. It's not, most of the time, it's not very noisy. It's just a little bit of gurgle going on there sometimes. But any little tiny sound, because I was doing some test shows and found out, I realized that it was these little sounds in the computer that were actually making a sound, were actually being picked up by my microphone. So if I'm, if the old microphone, I don't know, I've got it on the high setting so that I will be loud enough, and you can turn your volume down if I'm too loud because there's nobody here but me. Nobody on tonight's show but me. I've ordered a foam cover for our, what's called a windscreen for my new mic, which I'm not using right now, to minimize this type of background sound. And I hope with all these things, I've put the mic on the other side of the desk away from the computer, so that cuts down that knocking sound quite a bit. Lots of things to deal with the sound. But I want to move on now to thank Jaime Schwartz again, and also Carl for their recent donations, and also Troy for a DVD of Hitler Jugend Kicks, which I have to admit, Troy, I haven't looked at yet, but I will. I've got it ready to look at, like, tomorrow. So that's that. I was going to tell you also a little bit about January27th.org, a little update. You know, I spent a lot of time working with other people and getting that together and putting that online in December and January and even in November. Since about a week or two after the 27th, I really haven't gone over there much or done anything. I did add a video to it, and I had been totally taken up with lots of other things and forgot about it for the last few weeks, and I remembered and went to it guiltily yesterday, I think it was. And there it was, with even some people visiting. I could see it on the globe. Some people were visiting right there. I thought, oh, it's not totally, alone here. People are coming to look at it. Well, it's had 6,309 visits since it opened up, which of course is not a lot, but it's better than nothing. And I looked up the Alexa rank, because I'm going to give some Alexa rankings in a little bit here. And the Alexa rank for this site is 1,500,046. And I thought it would be worse than that because, it's just sitting there and there's nothing to make anybody go there. There's nothing new on it. It's just, it's pretty much a site that's set the way it is, although I do intend for more to be happening with it in this January 2015. So in the meantime, it's there. It's got plenty of good information, and I do encourage people to, if you haven't read everything on there, go there and read everything, because everything on there is top-notch, exceptional work about Auschwitz. And I want to say that January27.org is only about Auschwitz, Birkenau, because in conjunction with the commemoration of the, boy, listen to that rain. It's in conjunction to the commemoration of the end of the war, of the so-called liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau January 1945. Excuse me. It's there to debunk. The purpose of it is to show that nothing that is said about Auschwitz in the mainstream is true, and would tell the true story of it. because Auschwitz remains the big gun of the Holocaust, but it's just the fact that there are other important stories about Holocaust, but this is the one that can is associated with January 27th, Liberation Day. So they can't get away from Auschwitz when it comes to January 27th commemoration. Now, a news item from today, which I guess I'll just mention it. I just found it interesting. One point of it, I found it interesting. There's a story on the Daily Mail or the BBC about some new information that's been discovered about the Hindenburg, the 804-foot-long Zeppelin that crash-landed in New Jersey on May 6, 1937. And what I found interesting, there are pictures from another point of view, you might look for that, and that show that the Zeppelin seemed to be having trouble keeping its balance before it caught fire. But it did catch fire, but I don't know what it caught fire from. It didn't say in there that I noticed. But what it did say was that it was filled with flammable hydrogen because the Americans wouldn't sell helium to the Germans. Just think. In 1937, the Americans would not sell helium to the Germans. I guess the Germans didn't have helium. They needed to buy it from the Americans. The Americans wouldn't sell it to them, so they used hydrogen. And if it hadn't been for that, that thing wouldn't have caught fire because they had been able to fill it with helium. So it's the Americans' fault that 36 people died and a bunch of those other people must have been injured and had a lot of suffering and recovery to go through to get better, burns and so on. Well, that's that. Now, I'm going to take a look at my mail and see if I have any word from any listeners. I have to, gosh, this is ridiculous. Okay, I had to start everything all over again. Here he is. Hear you okay? He says, this is R.S. He says, it looks like the storm is passing north of Georgetown. Okay, well, it's right where I am, I can tell you that. I'm not going to say, but it's probably, they said it was going to be widespread. But I just wonder how distracting the, see if there's another one, how distracting the, Paul Hickman also writes and says audio is okay now, so I guess it wasn't okay for a while. There's one more here, I think. Although, voice just a bit low. Well, it's probably come up because, you know, this mic, it starts out low for some reason. But I'm sure it's come up. I've got it on the high setting. So it's probably too loud. Anyway, all right, thank you for those messages, friends. I really do. So let's go. Let me get back to the... Okay, and go back to the blog talk. All right. So I guess I will be able to do my show, maybe, unless some big thunderbolt strikes again. But so I will go on to Metapedia. I've talked about Metapedia before, what I found on Rodney Martin's Metapedia page. You know, Rodney Martin is one of the few white nationalist type people who has his own page at Metapedia, at least as far as I know. Why he has his own page is kind of a mystery. How people get pages. Most people aren't asking for them or trying to put them up, but I don't know how you put up a page. I know how to go in there and edit. That's all. So I did a little editing on that page, And, of course, what was on there was absolutely outrageous, like calling him doctor and a few other things which were total, which were very directed against me. And I changed the wording and so on. And it's still there. It's held. But I saw that there was the White Network was on there also, so I took a look at that. And I added Tanstoffel's name to the White Network page because they had said it was a it was created or something, formed or something just by Carolyn Yeager, and then they made some negative and critical, not just critical, but kind of nasty comments about Carolyn Yeager, that she has a reputation for being a disruptive element in the white nationalist movement and being anyway, it's probably written down here somewhere. So I looked up who was writing this stuff, and you know, the main culprit here is this fellow person named Basilius, who does the majority anymore of all the editing and work and stuff on Metapedia. And so I went to the White Network page again on Saturday, and I found that things had been added to it. And it said since the breakup of the White Network, and it said on 22nd April, Basilius added this to the White Network page. The network was ended by Tanstoffel in April 2014, who grew tired of Yeager's disruptive behavior and acidic personality. Can you imagine? I mean, you know, these people didn't even know Tanstoffel to begin with. They didn't even have his name on there. But now they learned about this, and they're still trying over there at Metapedia to make me look as bad as possible and to take really bad knocks at me. And I don't see them doing that to anybody else. I really don't. Except I have one thing to mention down here, down below, but it's not quite the same nature. So, I mean, talk about infighting and divisive. That's the word. They call me divisive and an infighter. And but talking about that, you know, that's what they're doing here by saying, by putting this reasons in here. They don't know. They're, or at least they're going by Tanstoffel's reasons, what Tanstoffel is saying, but not listening to me or not being fair-minded about it, because I've said absolutely the opposite of that. So I, on May 10th then, which was Saturday, went in to edit the page, and I changed it to the network was launched in May 2012 and was taken down and was, excuse me, and was taken over and shut down without warning by Tanstoffel on April 15th, 2014. Well, I thought that was fair because that's exactly what happened. It was taken over by Tanstoffel and he shut it down without any warning on April 15th, period. That's it. That's what happened. So I go back there today, this morning, and I find that, I went back the next day, Sunday. I went back Sunday, and I found that Basilius had changed what I had put in there, and he says the network was launched in May 2012 and existed until April 2014, when it was closed as Tanstoffel grew to oppose Yeager for a number of reasons. Well, you know, I didn't think that was fair either, because, again, it was that Tanstoffel had these reasons to do it, you know, to close it down, which he really, in the partnership situation we were in, he didn't have any reasons to close it down, but he just wanted to. So I didn't accept that. And also, Basilius put after his change, that is, all these things are recorded, so you can look and see who does what when. He gave us his reason for changing what I had written as paints an overly negative picture of Tanstoffel. See, so he thought that me saying that Tanstaffel took it over and shut it down without warning was an overly negative picture of Tanstaffel. But to say that Tanstaffel grew tired of Jaeger's disruptive behavior and acidic personality is not an overly negative picture of Carolyn Jaeger, because they want to be negative to Carolyn Jaeger. They've been so all along. So I changed it back. I changed it, and when I looked today, it was still there, probably because nobody's taking a look at it. But I changed it and said the network was launched. I got madder, you know. I made it a little bit worse than I had it before. The network was launched in May 2012 and existed until April 2014. Because he had already put that, he had that first part there in there. When it was closed by Tanstaffel, who had the technical control to do so, but without the consent of Carolyn Jaeger. Well, that isn't even really worse. That's correct. That's exactly what happened. Tanstaffel closed it because he had the control over it, but he didn't have the consent, and that's all. So I don't know if that will stay there, but I'm going to keep working on this. I actually think the whole page should come down because the white network doesn't exist anymore. And so why have a page at Metapedia about it with all this old junk on it? You know, people's desire to promote one side of something and tear down the other side. So I want to say, you know, that I've always, you know, I wonder who is behind Metapedia. And I've looked it up, and there's, of course, not a word about any names, any people. But there are editors there now, and Vasilia seems to be number one, at least when it comes to anything to do with white nationalism, pro-white advocacy. And they have a whole section where they call white patriot or white patriotism websites. I don't even know if it's white. I think it is, though. And I was looking that over and clicking on quite a few of them to see what they said this morning. And there's a whole lot that's not there. And, you know, it's not up to date, a whole lot of it. And there's a lot that you wonder why it's there, but maybe 10 years ago. No, this thing started in, like, 2007. So maybe, you know, although they didn't have this section, why they have what they have, I really don't know. It's just, again, it's a hit and miss. But they are very, very, I learned that they're very, very, very friendly with John Friend. Now, I'm not saying, and I want to make it clear that I am not implying in any way that I think Tanstaffel has anything to do with what's going on with the white network page at Metapedia. I'm sure he does not. And I'm sure he doesn't even look at it, or he may have looked at it since I talked about it before, but I'm sure he's not trying to put things on there at all, and he has nothing to do with it and doesn't care. Most people don't care what's over there. But I don't think that John Friend is doing anything either, but whoever this, and Vasilius is the one who's responsible for it. So whoever this Vasilius is, he likes John Friend, and he likes Rodney Martin, and he likes a few other people. But there are some people he doesn't like, they have Truth Militia on their list of patriotic websites amongst the newer ones. And yet, when you go to the Truth Militia page, it's all about John Friend. It says it was created by John Friend, and he did programs, and he did this and that, and Truth Militia. It's all about John Friend, and no mention whatsoever of Rich and Keith, who I associate with Truth Militia. And it may be that John started out, I think he had a program for a short while on Truth Militia, but it was run by Rich and Keith who started it, as far as I know, and John didn't stay on there very long. But yet this silly Metapedia site says it's all about John French. That's what they know about things, you see. They don't know what they're talking about. And they have a Stormfront page, of course, and it's very long. Most of these pages are like two or three sentences. Excuse me. And that's it. But two or three sentences, but the Stormfront is lots of stuff on there, which is, you know, there's a lot to say about Stormfront. It has a little bit of criticism on it somewhere down at the bottom, what people have said, but basically it's all positive, or neutral. So I looked for VNN, and they have a VNN page, and they have one sentence on this VNN page, just kind of nondescript. But recently, Basilius again added a second sentence, and this is what I want to point out to you. He added the sentence, Glenn Miller, federal informant and presumed shooter in the Overland Park, Kansas killings, posted over 12,000 comments on the forum under the name Rounder. Now, you see, that's true. But what has that got to do, really, with VNN? It's kind of a slam. It's definitely a slam at VNN. And why this Basilius wants to add something like that? Because he doesn't like, he's one of these Glenn Miller haters, as well as Ronnie Martin is. There's some kind of connection with these people who have a certain point of view that they want to present as the white nationalist movement and what they don't want to present, but they don't like. I wondered, I would like to know who this is, but I'll never find out because these people are totally anonymous. And this is the way it operates. And the only good thing is that if you sign up like I did, you can go in there and edit. And somebody can come along and unedit what you did. But you can come back and do it again, and somebody can come back. Anything can be on there if people put it on there. And that's what I'm talking about. You know, did I already say that I was the one who removed doctor from in front of Rodney Martin's name? And who put it there? Basilius. Basilius is the one who put it there, along with a bunch of other nonsense about how wonderful Rodney Martin is and how terrible Carolyn Yeager is. And I rewrote that thing, and it's hell because what I did was correct and accurate and also objective and not out to get somebody. That's the only good thing about it. But otherwise, it's kind of a funny situation, and it just shows you, and I've said this before, that when you go to these sites, you can't depend on the information that you find there. You can't. You can't depend on it at Metapedia less than you can depend on it at Wikipedia. I think Wikipedia has higher standards than Metapedia. And who are these people? I don't know. I don't know. But this is just one way to one area that leads me into what I would like to say about white nationalism. And I'm going to end up taking up too much time and not getting all my other stuff in with this, but it's not, I can't just say it in a few sentences and go on. So, you know, this morning I got a comment at carolynyeager.net where I have comments now. You can comment on the articles there now. And I got one from Enzog. And Enzog is a dear, dear person. But his comment was just simply a link to his latest blog post at enzog.blogspot.com. And I encourage people to go there because I didn't approve the comment. And I'm going to tell you why. It was a link to his blog post, Wither White Nationalism? ? And there's nothing wrong with the blog post. He goes into a lot of his own feelings about things and his own thoughts about it, which is very, very good and worthwhile. But I had already decided that my site, CarolynJaeger.net, is not about white nationalism. And whatever it was about white nationalism, it's not going to be in the future. But it never really was a whole lot about it. And so I'm not going to use my site anymore to promote white nationalism because I just don't want to call myself a white nationalist anymore. I'm a little bit discouraged and fed up with so much that goes on in white nationalism, and I have tried to be a constructive criticizer about it, but that's what happened at the White Network, why that happened with Tan. But at the same time, I don't feel like I fit in there very well. I never have felt like I fit very well. I'm certainly white. I want to live with white people. I've never done any kind of race mixing or hung out with non-white people or I'm a perfect example, except for not having children, of a white woman, you know, in my entire life and everything I've done. But I don't, and I want to live with white people. I'm totally pro-white. But white nationalism is kind of a different thing. You might say it's there's a whole lot under it, but basically it's a men's movement, and I feel I feel from men that so many of the men don't want women, or don't want women to say too much, or don't allow women any freedom, or don't are not good examples of whites themselves. There's such a problem in it. And I am a nationalist. I want to say that. And that's why Inzog, I didn't post the link to your. It's a little thing, but I just thought, no, I don't think I will do it. But I do encourage people to go there and read it. So the other thing I want to say is that what was it? I'm not using notes here, but I'm a nationalist. I am a nationalist. And, you know, to me, a nationalist has to have a nation. You have to have a nation to be a nationalist about. And we all know that there's no such thing as a white nation except in the idea form, and that's fine for a lot of people. But again, it's very much men. And it's just something that I don't feel comfortable in anymore. And I like to take my nationalism as in a different way. There are a lot of people who are nationalists and who have a connection to a certain nationality that they're nationalists about. Like say Paul Hickman, who is a white nationalist, but he's a British nationalist, but he likes white nationalism. He wants to combine them. That's his business, what he does. But there are people who don't have. There are Americans who are so mixed amongst ethnicities, and Tan is one of them, that they don't really connect with one particular nation as far as blood and soil go. See, because I'm a real blood and soil person, and I don't feel that. I don't feel that in America, but you can be an American nationalist. I think people should be American nationalists, but it's not something that I can really do with a lot of feeling and my real heart and soul. So I think I'll stop there. If there's any questions, I'm going to welcome callers to call tonight, and the number is not a toll-free call, but you can call 323-642-1206. 323-642-1206. All right. Now I was looking around at some things. I was looking at some Alexa rankings yesterday, and I found that worldviewfoundations.org is no longer online. Didn't have any Alexa ranking anymore. And then I went to it and found the site had been taken down. Whether it's temporarily or what, I don't know. But anyway, it was down. Because I noticed that at Metapedia, where it had, which naturally they have ANAANN.com on their white patriot website. There's a lot of things they don't have, but they have that one. And that one is combined with Worldview Foundations. It's the both of them are there together. So Worldview Foundations is now kind of merged into ANAANN, but you don't see any of what was on that website there, at least at the moment. And I was just amazed to find that the Alexa ranking of ANAANN has gotten worse. I mean, it was bad enough. It was at 4 million and 5 million. Now it's at 6 million. This was yesterday. 6,286,614 means it went down like about 2 million or up, down, whatever, lost about 2 million recently. So instead of them growing like leaps and bounds like they keep saying, they're definitely not. When you're at a number like that, it means nobody goes there. Because I was saying, that's why I was telling you earlier that January27.org, it's had 6,309 visits since January 27th. Though actually it was January 23rd or 4th or something like that when it started. That's not very much, you know. That's just barely, you know, there's a bunch of people. There's a lot of visits right at that time. And then it slowed down, and now it's probably at a snail's pace, really. And yet it's got an Alexa rank of 1,500,000. So if you've got 6 million, what's going on? I just don't even understand numbers like that. Now, I looked at some others. Sorry, but I did. Now, what is an even worse Alexa ranking than Rodney's is the White Network -archive.com, 8,258,398. Now, admittedly, it's brand new, but all these people who are supposed to want to go to that, have that stuff archived so badly and listen to Tan's old shows and so on, it was just a handful of people who are talking to him about that on his blog, because there's no big rush there. It's been there for a while, but nobody's going there. I mean, nobody's going there. Must be pretty sad. So I looked at Age of Treason, Tan's blog, which he's been running since 2005 for 10 years now, and has a following there. Gets comments, you know, from his following and so on. So it's not that people don't go there, yet it has an Alexa ranking of 3,148,142 as of yesterday. That's just as bad as 6 million. Really, I don't think there's a whole lot of difference between when you get up like that. 3 million, 6 million, 8 million, it's all pretty much nothing's going on there. And then I looked at Alternative Right. I just picked one off that Metapedia page. So I just picked out Alternative Right, which I think is Richard Spencer. I'm pretty sure that's Richard Spencer. And he's supposed to have, supposedly a good reputation of one of these new right people. But he's got a Blogspot page, you know, just like Tan does. It's alternativeright.blogspot.com. What's his rank? 3,589,785, worse than Age of Treason. So what is it with these people who have these big names that people recognize, but nobody's reading their stuff except a little following that they have? Now, how is it that CarolynJaeger.net can have an Alexa ranking as of today, this I saw it again today, of 283,163. You see, I've been coming down quite a bit. I've come down about 100 points in the last month, and I'm still coming down because on Sunday it was 290, and on Monday it's 283, so I just keep coming down, and I hope I keep coming down. I'm going to try to. And my United States rank is 57,605. That's not bad. I want to compare that to, well, I don't want to give these. I've got some others here, but I'll, how about, no, I won't even go into those people either. I will compare it to Krista Genia, Bill Fink's website, which is a very large website and very popular. And he's got great numbers for, you know, he's Christian identity. People think, well, who's, you know, how many Christian identity people are there? Well, there must be quite a lot, or they like what he has to say there. Of course, he also has the Mein Kampf site. But his ranking yesterday was 126,162 and 31,695 United States. So you see, I would love to get to where he is. I don't know if I could, because you have to have a broad enough selection of things on your site to get into those really low numbers, and I'll never have that. But that's why Stormer is so got such great numbers, because you know it's that kind of a site. It was copied after the model for it was Alex Jones' site. You know, with lots of different news items, lots of catchy things, and lots of pictures and all that. So there's a lot for people to learn when they go there, just to get all the news and so on. And now he started some radio programs, and he's they might do some videos, whatever. I don't know if that will improve or make it worse. But anyway, you know, you have to have something like that to get these, or a big forum like Stormfront with lots of people going there every day, and or lots of comments and so on. So I think I'm doing exceptionally well. In fact, I'm quite amazed at it, and I'm encouraged by it. And I just thought I would bring these things out. Okay, now I'm going to move to the German Reich, which is my stated topic for tonight. I want to talk about exactly what happened in May of 1945 after the surrender, but I'm going to start before the surrender. And I'm already 15 minutes before the 1 hour mark, so I'm just going to go right through. I could play. I still haven't gotten any break music. I forgot that I need some. I've got these Lily Marlene things here, which are very nice. I might play one of those if I need to take a break. But I'm going to just keep going as long as I can. Boy, it's quieter outside now. That's one nice thing. And my throat's a little... All right. The name Deutsches Reich was occasionally applied in contemporary maps to the Holy Roman Empire, because the German Reich is actually the Deutsches Reich, and but it applied to the Holy Roman Empire, which was from 911 to 1806, and it was also called the Holy Roman Empire of the German Nation from the 16th century onward. So the first attempt to establish a German empire was in 1848, the March Revolution, by the Frankfurt Constitution, which ultimately failed. It was aborted by the monarchs of the German Confederation, especially the King of Prussia, who were fighting German nationalism. The monarchs didn't want these didn't want this revolution and didn't want this Germanism. They wanted to keep their particular, kingdoms and so on the way they were. They didn't want to unite as one nation. So the First Reich, and now here's where the First, Second, and Third Reich. I learned something here, and that's what I'm talking about. It's very important because on Thursday, that Hitler Table Talk program that had all the rumbling in it, Marcus commented. That doesn't matter what Marcus commented, but I said, I got a little confused when we started reading about that or talking about it. And I said to Ray, which was the Second Reich and which was the First Reich? And it was like, he was saying it was the way that it officially is stated to be. That the First Reich was started with in 1871 to 1918. And then the second was the Weimar regime, and the third was, of course, Hitler's regime. But somewhere I thought that's not what I remember hearing or learning, and now I've found out that Hitler saw it differently, and that's what I was thinking about, because I thought that the Second Reich was Bismarck. And so then that means, what was the First Reich? And I thought, the Holy Roman Empire. And that's what Hitler... apparently, that's how he apparently put it together. The first, now let me see here. But the First Reich was the monarchy presided over by an emperor from the Prussian House of Hohenzollern, known in English as the German Empire of 1871 to 1918. But it is often called the Second German Reich to signalize continuity with the Holy Roman Empire. And this is the way Hitler had it, as far as I can understand what I was reading today or yesterday, that the Holy Roman Empire was the First Reich from 1911 to 1806. The Second Reich was the time of Bismarck's 1871 to 1918, which makes the Weimar Republic not a Reich at all, something that was left out, some kind of anomaly or something that didn't fit in. Officially the Second Reich was this Weimar Republic, 1919 to 1933, but Hitler didn't consider this a Reich, or it was just something a period that wasn't German rule, that wasn't truly German rule. The after World War One, when they enforced the kind of laws and so on, and reparations and conditions, and took away the Germans being self-rulers during that time. And then, of course, the Third Reich, 1933 to 1945, this source says that it's a Nazi attempt to give themselves legitimacy through a proclaimed continuity with the First Reich. So in the Nazi system, the Holy Roman Empire and the Hohenzollern was the First Reich, and the Hohenzollern, the First Reich was the Holy Roman Empire and the Hohenzollern German Empire. And that was the First Reich, 911 to 1806 or so, the Second, 1871 to 1918, and then the Lost Period, I'm calling it, 1918 to 1933, and the Third Reich, 1933 to 1945. Well, I might be all wet with this, and anybody can tell me that I am, and I, it's just my first look at it, but this is something that I did discover. It's in, not everybody agrees with this, agrees on this, I should say. So that, I think, is what I had been, why I was thinking about it. I couldn't quite get it straight, and I'm glad I learned about this from that. So then, following the Anschluss annexation of Austria in 1938, Germany, National Socialist Germany, informally named itself the Greater German Reich, or Grossdeutsches Reich, and made the official state name only during the last 2 years, though. Made it the official state name. They started calling themselves the Greater German Reich when they added Austria in 1938, but it didn't become official until 1943. And between 43 and 45, Germany was officially Grossdeutsches Reich, or the Greater German Reich. So the some notes I've got here: the German unification of 1871 never comprised all German lands, excluding those. This is not so important. There were some lands in that German unification that were not German, and there were the crown lands of Austria-Hungary, which had been part of the German Confederation until 1866. I don't have a real good grasp of this, so that's why I'm not reading it too well. The solution. The German Reich of 1871 comprised extended Prussian territories with large non-German sections of the population, like Posen, West Prussia, and Schleswig. So that's just the way the growing pains, I guess, of the unification of Germany after 1871. And apart from official documents, post-war one Germany was referred to as the German Reich, never as the German Empire. So after World War One, it was no longer an empire because the monarch had disappeared. But they called it the German Reich, and the word Reich was used untranslated by Allied prosecutors throughout the Nuremberg trials, with German Empire used only to signify pre-1918 Germany, for whatever that's worth. As of 1974, East Germany's official stance was that the GDR, that's the official name of the East Germany, was a new state that is German in nature, a successor of the German Empire, and that there were then two German states that were different nations, and the basic law for the Federal Republic of Germany was made with agreement of at least the Western Allied forces. It is also worth noting that the FRG was held responsible for reparations after the war, while the GDR denied any legal responsibility for the German Reich, that is Hitler's Reich. Now, this is just stuff that was in here. I don't even know if I should be reading it, but it has something to do with how, of course, it's important in understanding what is the true Germany, you know, whether the German Reich still exists, which it does. It does exist, but they don't want people to know it, and they don't want people to think about it. So I'll just go on here. In early April, the first Rheinwiesenlagers, those concentration camps of Eisenhower's along the Rhine for the German prisoners for the German soldiers, ex-soldiers, were established in Western Germany to hold hundreds of thousands captured or surrendered enemy personnel. And the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Forces reclassified all prisoners as disarmed enemy forces, not POWs. And this is admitted to be a legal fiction which circumvented provisions under the Geneva Convention of 1929. Even though people are not told this, and this is not talked about, but it was a legal fiction. It was legal, but it didn't have any any real basis that they should be able to do that, only because they were the law. They were the law, so they could do it. But by October of 1945, thousands had died in the... Wait a minute. Thousands had died in the camps from starvation, exposure, and disease. That's just on another sidelight there. But I want to go now to the political testament of Adolf Hitler, which was dictated on April 29, 1945. And in it, Hitler named Karl Dönitz as Reich's president. He abolished the office of, or the designation as a Führer, and went back to president. And so Dönitz was the Reich president, not the Führer. And he designated Joseph Goebbels as chancellor and Martin Bormann as party head. Now this shows how much confidence he had in Martin Bormann. And I'm a little tired of the attacks on Hitler's table talk based on some idea that bringing up the idea that Martin Bormann was suspected of being a Soviet spy. Suspected by whom? You know, who came up with these stories? Not responsible people who knew anything about it, that's for sure. So, but since Martin Bormann was such a bad person, and yet Hitler didn't know. Hitler was so foolish. He just put all his trust in Martin Bormann. He trusted Martin Bormann because he knew he could trust him, and Martin Bormann never let him down. He did everything he could do, and he was a darn hard worker. So I wonder where that is. Do I have that? Did I post this here? Oh, I guess I have to go to the page to look at it. I was thinking about reading Hitler's political testament, but I think now I'll bypass that because you can go and read it. It's really very interesting, though, and I thought it was appropriate for what I was talking about tonight to read it, but I think now, since I'm a little bit behind here, I better not. Dönitz accepted. Of course, Hitler was already dead, but Dönitz accepted the responsibility, and he asked. Von Krosigk. I'm a little bit off my. I need to talk about von Krosigk. The cabinet of Schwerin von Krosigk. Dönitz accepted this on May 1st, and he asked this von Krosigk, who was finance minister in the Hitler government, to be chancellor instead of Goebbels, who had committed suicide. Oh, I wanted to talk a little bit about that. You know, this was on the 29th, the night that Hitler and Eva Braun were married. And before the wedding ceremony, Hitler called his secretary Traudl Junge into this room, and he dictated his political testament and his will to her. And then he went out and, you know, spend time with the people out there they were having a party. And then she was working on typing all that up, because she takes it down in, some kind of shorthand, and then she had to type it all up in triplicate. She said for some reason it took her a while, and they were so impatient they kept coming in and seeing if she was finished yet, because they wanted to send two of them out as soon as possible by courier to some wherever they were being sent to, whoever they were being sent to. And so Goebbels, she says, Tribal Yoga says that Goebbels came in after a little while, and he was actually in tears, and he was just totally upset, and saying that that the Führer wanted him to take the position of chancellor. And he had already made up his mind what he was going to do, he and Magda. And he couldn't let Magda put the children to death and kill herself, and then he was going to go on and be chancellor. You know, he was just so upset. He said, I just can't do it. And he had probably never said no to Hitler in his life, but Hitler had put it in the political testament that he knew that what Goebbels wanted to do, but he hoped that he would accept this and accept this responsibility. And so Goebbels was just all torn up inside over this. But he did finally decide to let somebody else do it and not do it. And he went ahead with the suicide with Magda. And so Dönitz asked the finance minister that from Hitler's cabinet, von Krosigk, who was came from a pretty high aristocratic family, but, you know, good, loyal German, to be chancellor. And von Krosigk didn't want that title. He didn't want to be called chancellor, but he agreed to be leading minister along with the other ministers, and he formed a cabinet. And this was on May 2nd, and they moved to Flensburg to have their government there. I shouldn't say a little government, because it was the government of Germany, even though Germany was had already been defeated, and it was just a matter of, you know, signing the proper papers and so on. But they moved to Flensburg, which is a place way up north, right on the border of Denmark, where they still had control there. And everybody in Krosigk's cabinet were NSDAP members, except him. He never joined the party, but he worked for the government. And Albert Speer was still around, and he was behaving responsibly and trying to do the right thing for Hitler. And he was made Minister for Economics and for Armaments and War Production. And then you can go to the Wikipedia page on the cabinet of Speer and von Krosigk, and you can see the rest of them. There's some that are recognizable, but they're not anything too important. But they had this cabinet for Dönitz, who was the Reich's president. And on going back to the night of May 1st, Dönitz gave his first nationwide radio address, and he spoke of Hitler's hero's death and vowed the war would continue in order to save Germany from destruction by the advancing Bolshevik enemy. All the attention was put on stopping the Soviet advance or giving the Germans time to retreat out of the Soviet territory before they, you know, arrived, and to save German soldiers and civilians from falling into the hands of the Soviets. So Dönitz knew before he accepted the reins of power that Germany's position was untenable and that the Wehrmacht was no longer capable of offering meaningful resistance. So during his brief time in office, he devoted most of his efforts to ensuring the loyalty of the German armed forces and trying to ensure German troops would surrender to the British and Americans and not the Russians, as he feared the Soviet reprisals on the Germans. Well, we know how bad it was to fall into the hands of the Soviets, but they didn't understand or realize, nor would they have, how bad it was going to be to fall into the hands of the British and Americans also, and even the French. I mean, they were all terrible to the Germans. And, of course, we've already mentioned the Rhein-Riesenlager and Eisenhower's camps, and then also Eisenhower's terribly hateful laws and rules and against the German people for as long as it could go on. And the only reason that it stopped, Germans were starving to death, and the only reason that it stopped was because all of a sudden there was this trouble between the Soviet Union and the United States and Britain. So they decided they needed to have the Germans there as a buffer and use the Germans, so they had to quit punishing them the way they were doing. That's the only reason they stopped it. So anyway, this was what Donitz was trying to do. It was still only May 1st and May 2nd. And after Donitz made his radio broadcast on May 1st, this von Krosigk, his whole name is Lutz Graf Schwerin von Krosigk. Graf applies to the word count, means count. He made his first radio broadcast as a leading minister of the Reich on 2nd May. And at this time, Colonel General Alfred Jodl was chief of operations staff of the Wehrmacht, and he represented Donitz in negotiations with the Allies in Reims, France. And Field Marshal Wilhelm Keitel was chief of the High Command of the Armed Forces, and he represented Donitz in negotiations with the Red Army in Berlin. So, all right. I don't know if Keitel was just staying in Berlin somewhere or what actually he was doing. I mean, Jodl was outside of there. I think he was in the Flensburg government. And maybe Keitel was there too. And then he went to Berlin for that surrender signing. I don't know. Admiral von Friedeberg was appointed to succeed Donitz as commander of the Kriegsmarine, the Navy, German Navy, because, of course, Donitz was the commander of the Navy, commander-in-chief of the Navy, and now he became president. He appointed his assistant or second-in-command, von Friedeberg, to become the commander. And he was promoted to the rank of general admiral on 1st of May. So they were still taking themselves seriously. They didn't just collapse and say, okay, oh, gosh, it's all over. No, they were all running around and doing the best they could. And here Field Marshal Robert Ritter von Grimm remained as commander of the Luftwaffe. And I know a little more about him because Hannah Reich, who I've written about and read about, was flying around with von Grimm at this time because he had a wounded foot. There seems to be a possibility that they were lovers. They had been good friends for a long time, and that maybe they were lovers, Hannah Reich and von Grimm, head of the Luftwaffe. But I can't say that for sure. I'd like to know, but I don't know for sure. Anyway, there was not much left of the Luftwaffe. The Luftwaffe was the most destroyed part of the German Wehrmacht. So there just wasn't much for him to do. But there were still some planes, and they went to various places, flew around, and it's amazing how they, under all kinds of anti-aircraft fire and so on by the Soviets, to get here and there to tell people what to do. And they eventually got all the planes that they had to go to Berlin and try to protect it, continue to protect it. That was about the last act of the Luftwaffe. So on May 4th, Donitz sent Admiral Friedeberg to Field Marshal Montgomery, British Field Marshal Montgomery, to negotiate a surrender to the Western Allies. And Montgomery said wasn't friendly to that. He said only unconditional surrender was acceptable. Nevertheless, von Friedeberg signed an instrument of surrender for all German troops in the Netherlands, Denmark, and northwestern Germany, which was accepted by Montgomery on behalf of the Allied powers. Now, what was happening was that the Germans were trying to surrender to the Americans and the British. They didn't want to surrender to the Soviets. So that's why, they were trying to do that. But the Eisenhower, And the rest of them, and the Soviets, had this agreement that the Germans had to surrender unconditionally to all of them. They couldn't surrender, you know, whatever Germans were in the area where the Soviets were in control, they had to surrender to the Soviets. And the Germans were trying to everything to get out, to not surrender to the Soviets, or to surrender as much of their troops and civilians to the Americans and British, as possible. So on May 5th, von Friedeberg then arrived at General Dwight D. Eisenhower's headquarters at Reims, France, to negotiate a total surrender, because they were demanding that they do this total surrender. And Colonel General Alfred Jodl, such a good man, arrived a day later. You know, Jodl and Keitel worked with Hitler all the time. They were the high command of the armed forces, Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, and the generals were the army chiefs and so on. But Hitler had initiated another military command that was over and above the other one. I can't think of what it's called now, but they're very similar names. Anyway, this was the Oder Bay, and the other one was the Oder something else. Oder Ha. But anyway, he was always working with Keitel and Jodl. So they were pretty close to Hitler and understood what he was doing, and they had a lot of respect for him and his military expertise and good sense. So von Friedeberg then, who is the head of the Navy, the German Navy, went to Dwight Eisenhower's headquarters in Reims, France, to negotiate this total surrender. So they were still hoping they could, trying anyway, to negotiate a surrender, not an unconditional surrender. And Jodl then arrived there after Friedeberg a day later, and Dönitz had instructed both of them to draw out the negotiations for as long as possible so that German troops and refugees could move west to surrender to the Western powers. But Eisenhower realized what they were doing, and he was very hard-nosed about it, and he threatened them that he would close, if they didn't move on and sign this unconditional surrender, he would close the front, which meant that the German soldiers attempting to cross the line to surrender to the West, in the West, would be fired on, and all subsequent surrenders would have to be to the Soviets. Because as long as the front was open, they were still moving across it and still, moving into the Western zones, the Germans. So when they told Dönitz about this and he learned this, he realized that he couldn't hold off any longer, and he radioed Jodl full powers to sign the unconditional German instrument of surrender at 1:30 a.m. on the morning of the 7th of May. So that was how the Germans were forced to sign an unconditional surrender. And, nobody should ever sign an unconditional surrender if they can help it. But they had all these German people whose lives were at stake, or whose futures, because they were either going to be stuck with the Soviets, or some of them still get over to the Western powers. And they thought that would be so much better. So that's why they signed that unconditional surrender, which is a horrible thing for anybody to do, because you're then nothing but a slave. You have no rights, no nothing at all. But they did it. So it was signed by this Soviet general, Ivan Suslo-Parov, at Sheaf. He signed on behalf of the Soviets. But then the Soviets said he didn't have the authority to sign the surrender. He was the only one that was there at the time. So they demanded that another surrender be signed in Berlin with Marshal Zhukov at his headquarters. So then on May 8th, Keitel and von Friedeberg and Stumpf, who was the, Friedeberg was the Navy, Keitel was the Army, and Stumpf was the, I think he was representing the Air Force for Germany. Those three, because it was a military surrender. But this is another point that has meaning for future consideration of the nature of this surrender. It was the military surrender. That's all. In the first one that Jodl signed, and this one in Berlin that these three signed, they signed another instrument of surrender with Marshal Zhukov. So, and they were accepted as the representatives of Germany, approved of by Dönitz, who was the president. So on 9th of May, Dönitz issued orders to the German armed forces regarding the surrender. That is, he told them that they had surrendered and that they should surrender. What a sad thing. Lay down your arms. They couldn't put it off any longer, and that's the day that the Russia celebrates as their great victory day, May 9th. And so after the surrenders were signed, Albert Speer suggested in Flensburg that their Flensburg government should dissolve itself. But Dönitz and his ministers chose to continue in the hope of presiding over post-war Germany as a provisional government. Now, that was a far-fetched hope, but still, they thought, why just give up? You know, we'll still try to have some kind of influence and to have some kind of a say over Germany, you know, in the future if it's at all possible. So they continued with their Flensburg government, which was called that because it was in the town of Flensburg. So then here's something interesting. Churchill announced to the British public that the surrender had been authorized by Grand Admiral Dönitz, the designated head of the German state. And by saying that, he thereby recognized the Flensburg government as representing the German state. But they, you know, that they, you can't make anything out of that because they don't let you, but he still did it. We're at May 9th, and on May 7th, 1945, all German forces were ordered to remain in their positions and surrender. But there was a battle going on, the Battle of Slivice, I think is how it's pronounced. It's Czech. It was in the Czech area, and I think that's how it's pronounced, Battle of Slivice. And it turned out to be the last large World War II battle, and it took place in the Czech lands, and it was during 11th and 12th of May. But you know, I'm getting ahead of myself here a little bit. All right, let me go back to that. So the German forces were ordered to remain in their positions and surrender. Now, Field Marshal Ferdinand Schirner was in Bohemia in this this battle of Slivice. Slivice. And he was in Greece. He was one tough leader. His men hated him because he just demanded so much, and he was so tough. He was tough himself, but he got amazing things accomplished by his men, but they didn't like it, what he made him, you know, what he demanded. However, you know, he's got a good reputation in anyway because he did so many great things. But he was the commander of the Army Group Center at that time, which were deployed in Bohemia, and he ordered his units to force their way westwards instead of to lay down their arms and surrender. He says, no, we're going to keep going west and see if we can surrender to the American forces, because the Soviets were on their way to this area. And his units reached the agreed demarcation line in western Bohemia and stopped there. And the Soviet army was still days away from this line, but the partisans that were around tried, mostly unsuccessfully, but they tried to stop the Germans. And the Germans responded with reprisals against the local population. And on several occasions, Russian Liberation Army units, now that's partisans, skirmished with the Germans. Now these Russian, no, that's not the partisans. These, okay, I think these Russians were not loyal to the Soviets, and they wanted to reach the Americans too. All right, that's what this is. They didn't want to be taken prisoner by the Soviets because they were going to treat them worse than anybody else because they were considered deserters and traitors or whatever. But they sometimes skirmished with the Germans, it says here, at this time. Well, they were both at this trying to surrender to the Americans. Then on 9th of May, a large formation of German troops reached the area between the villages of Malin, Slivichi, and Similichi near the demarcation line. Among them were parts of the Kampfgruppe Wallenstein, the fighter group Wallenstein, and the 2nd SS Panzer Division, 4th SS. So that takes us then to this last battle on the 11th and 12th of May in Slivichi. And the American troops were defending themselves against both local partisans and then finally the Soviet army. The Soviet army finally arrived, and they had not been able to cross the line, I guess, and surrender. And they fought the Soviets as long as they could. There was quite a battle there and a lot of deaths. And the Germans eventually had to capitulate during the early hours of May 12th. That's today, you see. That's what I started out this program with. Today is May 12th, and this is when this battle, when this final surrender. These were the last people to surrender, as far as I know, in World War II, the last Germans. And 6,000 men were captured by the Soviet troops. Yuck. On May 12th, then, American Major General Lowell W. Rooks and his British deputy, Brigadier E.J. Ford, arrived in Flensburg. So they had been leaving the Flensburg government alone up until now. But now this American Major General and his British deputy came to Flensburg and established their quarters in the passenger ship Patria. Which is because Flensburg was there on the water. There was all kinds of water around there, as Denmark is surrounded by water. So they, imposed the will. Oh, they came there to impose the will of the victorious Allied powers on the German high command there in Flensburg. So even though they had arrived there, they weren't doing anything too much, and everything kept going until May 20th. The Flensburg government kept going until May 20th when the Soviet government attacked the Donetsk administration in a Pravda article calling it the Donetsk Gang and harshly criticized any idea of allowing it to retain any power. So then on May 23rd, a British officer went to Donitz's headquarters and asked to speak to the members of the government. Donitz was there. Von Friedeberg and Jodl were invited to come aboard the Patria, where the American and British had set up their quarters. I had been there for a while. They invited them, which means they couldn't turn it down. They were taken aboard the Patria, where Major General Rooks informed them of the dissolution of their government and their arrest. Excuse me. By the time Dönitz emerged from the ship, the town's main street was filled with British tanks and troops rounding up the Germans. Whatever Germans were living there, were living around there, they were being rounded up. And von Friedeberg committed suicide. How he may have had something on his body that he could do that with. It doesn't say what he, if he took one of those capsules and bit into it, or if he had a knife with him or a gun or something. But he committed suicide right then. But Dönitz, Speer, Jodl, and the other members were taken prisoner. And there was a, well, from that point on, there was no central authority, German central authority, in place to govern Germany, or any central authority in place to govern Germany, or even to assume responsibility for complying with the demands and instructions of the victorious nations. Now, there was, I came across a newspaper article from Lewiston, Maine, Evening Journal, May 23rd, 1945. And it's I'll just read it. It came out on that very day. The news went out, and it says the heading is "All Members of Flensburg Government Arrested." Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force, Paris, AP. Supreme Headquarters announced today the arrest of all members of the so-called Flensburg Government, and an official source said this meant that henceforth Allied officers would deal directly with the German people and German prisoners. Members of the high command in Flensburg were taken into custody along with the government figures as prisoners of war, it was announced. This means the dispersal of the high command, the official source said. Those arrested included 300 officers and a number of other ranks and civilians, the announcement said. And then in parentheses, they had Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz, who succeeded Hitler as Führer, presumably was among those arrested as a prisoner of war. Well, of course, they're wrong that he succeeded Hitler as Führer. He succeeded Hitler, but not as Führer. That's a shameful, way that they handled that, but maybe it was the only way they could handle it. They probably thought it was a pretty good way to handle it. But on that was the 23rd of May, and the next date I have here is the 5th of June, 1945. Of course, these men were imprisoned, and later they were all put on trial as the war criminals in the Nuremberg trials, all of them. And the one who, the smart one was the one who committed suicide, von Friedeberg. But the others felt they probably Dönitz felt he couldn't do that because he was still trying to represent Germany and do his duty. So the Allies on June 5th signed something they called the Declaration Regarding the Defeat of Germany and the Assumption of Supreme Authority by Allied Powers. This means that the declaration, the four powers assumed, no, this means, it's not this means, by means of this declaration, the four powers assumed direct control of the administration of Germany with absolute powers. It was signed by Eisenhower, Montgomery, and Zhukov, and some French guy. They always had the French in there, although the French really were not the victors, but they included them anyway. The declaration contained the following statement. The governments of the United States of America, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, and the United Kingdom, and I thought it was interesting that in this case, the United Kingdom came in third, and the Soviet Union came in second. Probably has some meaning. And then they add, and the provisional government of the French Republic, hereby assume supreme authority with respect to Germany, including all the powers possessed by the German government, the high command, and any state, municipal, or local government or authority, the assumption for the purposes stated above of the said authority and powers does not affect the annexation of Germany. Now, I don't understand that last sentence there. I've thought about it and thought about it. I don't know what it refers to, but I included it. Anyway. And so, therefore, from 5th of June, 1945, Germany did not possess any kind of native government or any kind of self-government. It was ruled from without. The Allied Control Council was the immediate successor of the Donitz administration in the government of Germany. So that is the end of that sorry and sad story. For whatever worth it is, I thought since this, I missed talking about the May 8th and 9th and so on, that I would just talk about the whole month of May today and give a rundown. I probably hope I didn't wander off too much. I'm still not fully focused on what I'm doing here, although the storm has subsided now. NASHI, I want to talk about now. I've got 30 minutes. So once again, I invite anyone to call in if they feel an urge to call. 323-4, can't get that right, 642-1206. But I thought I wanted to say a little bit about Putin, and I was looking up some things about him and came upon this NASHI, which is a political youth movement in Russia, which declares itself, excuse me, to be a democratic, anti-fascist, anti-oligarchic capitalist youth movement. Its creation was encouraged by senior figures in the Russian presidential administration, and by late 2007, it had grown in size to some 120,000 members, whose ages were between 17 and 25. So on April 6, 2012, just recently, 2 years ago, the leader of NASHI announced that the movement would be dissolving in the near future, possibly to be replaced by a different organization. He stated that the movement had been compromised during the recent presidential election. Well, I don't know exactly what's being referred to there, but there has been a lot of talk about, it seems like it still exists, but there's a lot of talk about reorganization, and maybe because it got such a bad reputation for being a violent group of people for the violence that they carried out. I was looking at a story right before we started, but I didn't include it, but it was talking about when they were protesting in Estonia about the moving of that statue. I'm going to go into that a little bit in a minute, but that's, they really went all out. There was a picture there. There are these Russians in Estonia, and this youth group goes to Estonia, and they stir up all these protests against the Estonians. And there is a picture there of a political poster. It looked like it was a woman's face on the Estonian, near the Estonian embassy. They were, for elections and so on. And they had drawn in a Hitler mustache on this woman's face and some scratches to make hair hanging down on one side to make her look like Hitler. But of course she didn't, but anyway, that they were defacing things. That's how these people are, NASHI. They're pretty aggressive, very aggressive. And so a little bit about this organization, and it is an organization that was started under the auspices and with the approval and with the desire of Vladimir Putin. The movement was officially announced by this very important person in it named Vasily Yakimenko. He was the leader of the pro-Putin Walking Together youth movement in 2005. And so they started up this new movement, and the founding conference was in 2005, and it's thought that NASHI was established mainly as a reaction against Ukraine's Orange Revolution in 2004, in which youth-led street protests helped give the presidency to a pro-Western candidate, Viktor Yushchenko. So they wanted to form their own group of youths who would fight for the Russian candidates and for Putin and so on, or go out in the streets and do things for their side. And this Yakimenko has been in control of it all along, all this time. And he claims to have he claims that he constituted it as a movement to demonstrate against what he saw as the growing power of Nazism in Russia and to take on skinheads in street fights if necessary. And its funding comes from pro-government business owners, but it is widely reported that the group also receives direct subsidies from the Kremlin. Of course, Putin has been in power since 2000, right? So he was the president all this time, except for that period of time when he was the prime minister. let's see here. Yakimenko once said to a Russian newspaper that the Kremlin support makes it possible for the Nazi to tell businessmen, hey guys, we need money for a national project. And because the Kremlin is behind it, because Putin is behind it, they'll give the money. So the Nazi's close ties with the Kremlin have been emphasized by deputy presidential chief of staff during 1999 to 2011, whose name is Surkov. He has met the movement's activists on numerous occasions and delivered speeches and held private talks with this group from the president's office, see? And also Putin has too, but it has been speculated that the Kremlin's primary goal was to create a paramilitary force to harass and attack Putin's critics as enemies of the state. At one event for political education in summer 2006, the Kremlin advisor Gleb Pavlovsky told members of Nazi that they lacked brutality and you must be prepared, he said, to break up fascist demonstrations and prevent with force any attempt to overthrow the Constitution. And so critics have compared Nazi to the Soviet Komsomol, which was a pretty tough group of Soviet youth. During the Soviet Union days, the Komsomol, and also with Hitler Youth. But in my opinion, Hitler Youth were not ever violent. They didn't go out attacking and beating up people or anything like that. They were mainly being instructed in National Socialism, and they were loyal, and they were looked upon as leaders. They had leadership. Sure, they paraded around and marched and so on. And if they had to fight the anti-fascists and the commies and stuff that came along, well, they had to do that. But they weren't there to attack, and they were there to be the future leadership of the nation. But anyway, this Nazi has a pretty bad reputation for its actions. I guess it got a little tougher when it was told that they weren't tough enough. They had to be able to do street fighting and so on. And this Yakimenko confirmed in 2012 that the Nazi in 2010 received funding of about 200 million rubles from the Russian state budget. 200 million rubles to Nazi alone in 2010 from the Russian state budget. Their headquarters is housed in a 20 million pound, looks, what is that, a ruble sign? I don't know. Building in the center of Moscow. So, you know, it's a big deal. It's been a big deal. And this Yakimenko said in 2005 that the goal of the movement was to put an end to the anti-fatherland union of oligarchs, anti-Semites, Nazis, and liberals. So even in 2005, this vocabulary, this rhetoric about anti-Semites is there along with the Nazis and liberals. So they are supposedly conservative. Putin is supposedly conservative. And well, is the anti-oligarch, is for the people and so on. But also, he's not anti-Semitic and doesn't want, will not go along with any kind of anti-Semitism. And then they throw in the Nazis, too. Well, I'm sure there are youth in Moscow and in Russia that are consider themselves National Socialists. They like it. They like that. So several newspapers in Moscow suggested that that the group is actually a bit more specific. The purpose of the group is more specific than that, is to replace the party of power, United Russia. It's to take over the party of power, United Russia. That's Putin's party. And since Putin's in power, that's the party of power. But the youth group is to replace that party, whatever that means, I'm not sure. Not all of its goals are politically motivated, however. Now she organizes voluntary work in orphanages and old people's homes and helps restore churches and war memorials. Now, that then it sounds more like the Hitler Youth, you know, just doing lots of patriotic things and good things for the people. It also pickets shops accused of selling alcohol and cigarettes to minors and campaigns against racial intolerance. So there again we have that mixed race state of Russia, which is not, is they don't want racial intolerance. They don't want to be anti-immigrant or things like that. The Kremlin, a Kremlin advisor named Markov stated in 2005 that Nashi wants Russia to be a modern, strong, and free country. Their ideology is clear. It is modernization of the country and preservation of its sovereignty with that. Well, that would be Putin's goal and what Putin would be wanting to, you know, wanting to instill in these young people or to, tell them. One of the movement's main goals is preventing the introduction of foreign control in Russia. So, yeah, there's that. Russia doesn't want to be controlled from the outside. They are very wary about the United States. It's true. And the organization of Russia on the basis of which you have great groups now. Well, I'm going to let this part go because I don't have it figured out. All right, here's this thing about Estonia. From a 2009 story online, this is probably what I was looking at before the program. Nashi stages regular protests outside the embassies of Western states with which the Kremlin has disagreements, and its activists picket meetings of opposition parties. Now, you know, see, this sounds to me like what the communists always did. They organize protests everywhere in the West, and if the Kremlin doesn't like, if it's anti-Russian or anti-communist or whatever, they go out there and encourage people to march and picket and, protest in one way or another. And they're still doing that. That's the Russian way. That's the way they think about things. Because they still think about things, in my opinion, in the Soviet way. And this woman, Kristina Popchuk, a spokesman for the organization, the Nashi organization, said it had nothing to do with jamming Estonian internet sites. This is when that thing came out about these Soviet youth were, jamming Estonian internet sites and taking them over and so on. If anything, she says, it was a personal initiative of this one guy, but Russian officials allege that Estonia routinely discriminates against its Russian-speaking minority and accuses European institutions of turning a blind eye. Now, here's the thing, that it seems to me that the Russians are they have their people in as many other countries as they can. Like, there's a lot of Russians in Estonia, but not nearly enough that they should be running things. And there's Russians in the Ukraine, and there's lots of Russians in the United States. There's Russians everywhere. And these Russians, and just like they've always done, this is what was happening in the 20s, 30s, too, and the 19-teens, before the 1920s, where these Russians are all over the world, and they are stirring up trouble, and they're saying that they are being discriminated against. They speak Russian. Why don't the Russians in Estonia speak Estonian? No, they don't want to. They speak Russian, and then they say, well, you know, we're in the minority, and you're discriminating against us, and you're not letting us have our rights. And I think this is one of their big tactics. It's always been a communist tactic. The decision, this was all about moving this Red Army monument in Tallinn from the center of the city, their capital city, to a war cemetery on more outside of the center of the city. I don't know if it was on the outskirts of town or where it was, but it was a war cemetery where I suppose Soviet soldiers were buried. If you recall, Moscow made and Putin and Russia made a big, big fuss over this, just thought it was just terrible, because the, and here's what they said. They said that it was seen in Moscow as a deliberate snub to the sacrifices the Soviet Union made to liberate Eastern Europe from German occupation during World War II. Well, yeah. This sounds very much like Putin's recent speeches, doesn't it? You know, of glorifying the Soviet soldiers and the sacrifices they made to free the world from slavery and from Nazism and so on. But here they're saying that the sacrifices the Soviet Union made to liberate Eastern Europe when they enslaved Eastern Europe after the Germans left. And, you know, they just put everything crazy backwards, and yet this shows the mindset. There's something very, very wrong with that mindset. They're not looking for any kind of truth or reconciliation with people. They're pushing their own history onto everyone as much as they can. But the Estonians say that the Nazi rule was replaced by decades of brutal Soviet repression, which only ended with the fall of the Berlin Wall. And Estonia's government denies discriminating against Russian speakers. It said the presence of the Red Army monument in the center of the capital was causing public order problems, and that's why they moved it. Well, I don't even think they need to say it was causing public order problems. Why would they want a large monument to the Red Army in the middle of their capital city? They're not red. They're not Russian. And they don't have this gratitude for the Red Army that the Russians want them to have. Well, it tells us that on June 26, 2005, with the media present and photographers and everything, President Vladimir Putin met with a group of Nazi members at his residence in Zavidovo, and he expressed his support for the group, who were described as awestruck by his presence. So Putin has quite an image in Russia, and these youths, when they're able to come in physical contact with him, they are awestruck, which is pretty much the same as the way the Germans felt, and particularly the youth, but all the Germans felt about Adolf Hitler. They were, you know, awestruck when they were able to actually be there close to him and have him talk to them. So in August of that year, 2005, Putin officially invited Yulia Gorodnicheva, who was an undergraduate student of Tula State University and one of the members of NASHI, to become a member of the Public Chamber of Russia, but she refused to be selected by the president and wanted to run for the office or something like that, and which she then became a member of the Commission on Social Development. But in 2006, Nashi conducted a campaign against the British ambassador in Moscow, Tony Brenton, as he attended an opposition conference called Another Russia. So, see, this is just when they're the opposition to Putin, which exists in Russia, he wants to fight that down, and he uses the this youth group to go out and protest and make a lot of noise. And just like the anti-fascists do, in that we know against anything that they consider national socialist or right wing, they or pro white or whatever, they do that. And in April and May 2007, Nashi members held daily protests in front of the Estonian embassy in Moscow. Well, I don't know if they went. They may not have gone to Estonia to do that. I may have kind of implied that. There were the Russians in Estonia that were, the Russian-speaking people in Estonia were doing the protesting outside in Estonia about this, the moving of the bronze soldier in Tallinn. And maybe that in that the Nashi members were doing their protesting at the Estonian embassy in Moscow. So but anyway, they were carrying signs. Some members were carrying signs stating, "Wanted, the ambassador of the fascist state of Estonia," and Estonia was spelled lowercase e, uppercase SS, and then lowercase TONIA, to indicate that they were fascist SS Nazis. Because they wanted to move this soldier statue out of the center of Tallinn, red soldier statue. They also used that Estonia when they accused the Estonian state of cultivating fascism elsewhere. And let's see. They, in 2007, Putin met with several Russian political and environmental youth organizations, including Nashi, at his residence at the same place and discussed various issues affecting Russian society. At the meeting, he stated that the United Kingdom was acting like a colonial power with a mindset stuck in the 19th or 20th centuries, due to their belief that Russia could change its constitution, allowing Andrei Lugovoy to be extradited to the UK to face charges in relation to the Alexander. Anyway, he's saying that that the United Kingdom was saying we should change our constitution, advice that I view as insulting for our country and our people. They need to change their thinking and not tell us to change our constitution. Well, right, but I suppose, but they wanted to extradite, they wanted somebody extradited to the United Kingdom to face charges in relation to the Alexander Litvinenko affair. I remember that, but I can't say that I was really well versed on it, but I do remember it. So he didn't want to do that. He didn't want to extradite. It was against their constitution. Well, I mean, you know, he wants Russia to do whatever they want to do for themselves, to be totally, you know, independent, and they doesn't want to do anything the West wants them to do. That's all right, but he seems to think that he can go into the West or send his people or have Russians going and telling other people what they should do. He wants, you know, tell the Ukrainians what they should do, tell the Estonians what they should do. I do believe that Putin would like to take over more territory and would like to have this Estonia and Latvia and so on again, and would like to have the whole Ukraine, and it might very likely end up with it. So let's see. I've only got a few more minutes left. So I'll see what I've... at one point, in December 2007, this Nashi youth movement was planning to send a select group of activists to study at British universities because, despite their disdain for Britain, but they recognized that that they lagged behind in knowledge and experience vital for making Russia a 21st century world leader, and that British education was rated highly all over the world, and they thought if they had some graduates from British universities, it would help them, improve, come back and teach, bring that back to Russia. So they recognized that education and so many things are superior in the West, and yet, they don't want anything. There's a lot that they don't like about it, of course. And, again, this DDoS attack, more about that. Criticism of this. Nashi has been accused of recruiting skinheads and local hooligans to intimidate rival youth groups. A journalist said that Nashi's true function was as a personality cult for Putin, whose job was to intimidate, bully, and harass his opponents. And they derogatively nicknamed it Putin-Jugend, Hitler-Jugend, Putin-Jugend. And the National Bolsheviks don't like the Nashi. I don't quite understand this thing about the National Bolsheviks, because they say here that Alexander Dugin, is the National Bolshevik. Here's something, a quote, today Russia is considered to be the center of National Bolshevism, and almost all of the National Bolshevik parties and organizations in the world are connected to it. Amongst the leading practitioners and theorists of National Bolshevism are Alexander Dugin and Edward Limonov, who heads the unregistered and banned National Bolshevist Party in Russia. Influenced heavily by the idea of geopolitics, current Russian National Bolshevik movements propose a merger between Russia and parts of Asia, in a union to be known as Eurasia. In 2012, May, 2 years ago, Vasily Yakimenko, we started out with him, he's the one who organized this. He's in the presidential administration, and he's close to Putin. And he organized the Nashi in the beginning for Putin, and he's still the leader. In 2012, he was considered the leader of the movement of Nashi, and he reported on the establishment of a political party, Smart Russia. I've heard of that. Now, is that it says here May 23rd, probably in 2012, at the Congress of Nashi Movement, it was decided to establish a political party. Smart Russia was elected. The chairman of Smart Russia was elected commissioner on June 20th, and the party was officially registered as the Ministry of Justice of Russia. So in some way, they're connecting the Nashi movement with this new party, Smart Russia, as connecting it with youth and all. And where that's going, I don't know. But I found all that a little bit interesting, that Putin is there, and I've got to close out now. I'm not going to go overboard, overtime on this program tonight. So I'm going to say goodnight now, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much. Now that the show's over, the storm is over too. Good night.